This program is brought to you by Stanford on iTunes U at Stanford University. Please visit us at itunes.stanford.edu.
Let's get down now this morning to the actual text of the play. I gave you a general kind of background last time, and this morning I want to talk about the play itself. Now, more probably has been written about Hamlet than about any other single work in English literature. Perhaps more than any other work in any literature. I would guess that the published scholarship and criticism on the Oedipus the King would occupy maybe one or two library shelves. This published scholarship and criticism of Hamlet would occupy an entire library. Indeed, one is tempted to say that just about every possible and every impossible theory that the human mind could possibly conceive has been applied at one time or another to Shakespeare's Hamlet. And this raises the first question I want to address this morning, and that is simply, why? What is it about this particular play that has attracted such an immense volume of commentary, of scholarship, of explanation? What is the source of Hamlet's perennial fascination? Why is it the text that is taught more often in high school than perhaps any other? Why does every great actor, and some not so great actors, want to play this particular role? Here on the screen I have Richard Burbage, who was the original Hamlet. This is the guy who played the role of Hamlet when it was first appeared on the Elizabethan stage. Richard Burbage, the leading actor in Shakespeare's company. Then here are some others. David Garrick, way back in the 18th century. Edwin Booth, the brother of the gentleman who assassinated President Lincoln. There he is, the brother, Edwin. Henry Irving, a very famous Victorian actor. Forbes Robertson, a little later. John Gielgud, when he was a very young man. He's now plays very aged parts, but then he was, when he played Hamlet, he was a young man. Laurence Olivier, some of you may have seen the splendid movie starring Olivier as Hamlet. There, the man who, for my money, is the greatest actor of his generation, the Welshman, Richard Burton, husband for a short time of Elizabeth Taylor. There is Kenneth Branagh, who is a fine actor but appeared in one of the very worst adaptations of Hamlet that I ever hope to see. There is Mel Gibson, the man I had in mind when I said not so good actors. He, if you're interested in an Oedipal interpretation of the plays I will be providing you with this morning, Mel Gibson's version is the version to see. It is by far the most Oedipal. There, finally, is Ethan Hawke, who appeared in a quite extraordinary modern production movie of the play, which I thought was extremely intelligently done and very, very ingenious in the way that the plot devices were adapted to our modern times. So there are just a few of the actors who played this role. Well, the answer to my question, I think, isn't really too far to seek, although it has some rather complex and interesting ramifications. And the answer that I want to give you is, quite simply, that the character Hamlet is himself a mystery. And that's why we keep on reading and rereading and reperforming the play. T.S. Eliot once said that the play and its character, its hero, Hamlet is the Mona Lisa of literature. Now that's a rather nice way, it seems to me, of putting it. But despite the efforts of generation after generation of literary critics and scholars, Shakespeare's hero still today remains, it seems to me, inscrutable. Every attempt to pluck out the heart of his mystery has proved to be, in one way or another, a failure. Moreover, to an even greater extent, I would say, than Oedipus the King, the play as a whole seems to be impenetrably opaque. It seems to resist comprehension. And as such, of course, it challenges our natural human need, our basic human need, to resolve problems, to elucidate mysteries. It provokes our admirable rationalistic urge to make sense of literature as we like to make sense of life, to discover some kind of coherent principle in events, to comprehend our fellow human beings. In short, Hamlet defies, and thus I think tantalizes, our natural desire to understand things, to unravel enigmas, to solve puzzles. Hamlet appeals, if you like, to the Oedipus in all of us. Now, what is the puzzle? Well, on the face of it, it's a fairly straightforward one. Crudely stated, the puzzle about Hamlet's character is, why on earth doesn't he act sooner? Why doesn't he act sooner? He says as much himself. He asks himself over and over again why he doesn't kill Claudius earlier in the play. In his own words, this is from Act 4, Scene 4, line 43 on page 101 of our text. He says, I do not know, while yet I live, to say this thing's to do. Sith I have cause, and will, and strength, and means to do it. So why haven't I done it? Now, it's interesting that this problem is unique to Shakespeare's version of the Hamlet story. Remember that, like Oedipus the King, Hamlet grew out of a long mythological tradition, going back, in this particular case, all the way to a 12th century chronicler. There's a very handy summary of the earlier versions of Hamlet on page 167 at the back of your text. Now, in all previous versions of the story, in all of them, there's no mystery at all about why Hamlet delays. He may, like Shakespeare's character, have had the cause and will and strength to do it, but he lacked the means. Because in those earlier versions, Claudius, after killing Hamlet's father, felt so vulnerable, so at risk, that he surrounded himself with an impenetrable bodyguard. Hamlet simply couldn't get at Claudius to carry out his revenge, and his assumed madness was simply a device, an attempt to find a way through Claudius's defenses. But Shakespeare's Hamlet has the means as well. There's no hint anywhere in this text that Claudius has taken the precaution of surrounding himself with a vigilant bodyguard to protect him, as in the earlier versions. Indeed, it's not until the play within a play scene that Claudius becomes even aware that Hamlet knows that his father was murdered. And even when Claudius is aware of it, in the very next scene, Hamlet can come upon him alone, wholly vulnerable, unguarded, alone at his prayers. Now, as I say, a bewildering number of theories have been offered to explain Hamlet's delay, his inaction. One could give quite literally a whole course on them, but I think you can reduce them basically to four versions. There's, by the way, on the right-hand side of the screen, there's the castle of Elsinore. That's those are recent photographs. There's a royal castle in Denmark with that name, and there it is. Now, as I say, the theories about Hamlet can be reduced to four, I think. First of all, there's what I'm going to call the theological solution. Secondly, there is the moral solution. Thirdly, the psychological solution, the most interesting in my view. And fourthly, the aesthetic solution. Now, I'm going to talk about the first three this morning and the fourth next time, next week. So, first of all, let's begin with the theological school. According to this theory, the key to the first half of the play is the nature of the ghost. Because it's been argued that the first question to have occurred to an Elizabethan audience watching this play would have been, where does the ghost come from? And in order to answer that question, they would have had to answer a prior question, a much more difficult one. Is the ghost a Catholic ghost or a Protestant ghost? Or more precisely, perhaps, is the ghost presented or conceived in Protestant terms or in Catholic terms? Now, to our modern ears, I think that question sounds a bit strange. But to an audience that was living, remember, in the aftermath of the Protestant Reformation, which had erupted in England only 70 years before the performance of Hamlet in London, to that audience, this question would have been absolutely central. Because if the ghost were conceived in Catholic terms, then it could come from purgatory. Purgatory, that in-between zone between paradise and hell. If it were a Protestant ghost, however, it could only come from heaven or hell, since the Protestant Church denied the very existence of purgatory. Now, there seems to be little doubt that Hamlet and Horatio are Protestants, and that Shakespeare affirms that the Denmark of Hamlet was a Protestant country, as indeed it was in the late 16th century when it was a bulwark of Lutheranism. Hamlet's university, as I mentioned last time, Hamlet's university is Wittenberg, the cradle of the Protestant Reformation, Martin Luther's own university, and one of the great intellectual centers of Protestantism. So it's pretty clear that Hamlet's a Protestant. As a result, quite naturally, when Hamlet and his companions are talking about the ghost, they consider only the two Protestant alternatives. One, that the ghost is a devil in disguise, come from hell to tempt him, or alternatively, the ghost is an angel from heaven come to instruct him. Hamlet puts it very, very clearly in Act 1, Scene 4, line 40 on page 25. He says to the ghost, be thou a spirit of health, an angel, or goblin damned, a devil, bring with thee airs from heaven or blasts from hell. No mention whatsoever of a third possibility, purgatory. What complicates matters, both for Hamlet and for us, is the fact that the ghost describes himself in distinctly Catholic terms. In Act 1, Scene 5, line 9 in particular, he uses, this is on page 28, the ghost uses language which clearly implies the Catholic conception of purgatory. The ghost says, I am thy father's spirit, doomed for a certain term to walk the night, and for the day confined to fast in fires, till the foul crimes done in my days of nature are burned and purged away. Purged away. He is in purgatory. But then, having said that, immediately afterwards, he confuses matters completely by addressing Hamlet from underneath the stage. And in the Elizabethan theatre, the area underneath the stage was hell. That's where devils pop up in plays like Dr. Faustus. So there are very, very good grounds then in the text for Hamlet's doubts about the origin and nature of the ghost. As he explains to Horatio, the play scene is absolutely necessary in order to test the veracity of the ghost. On page 70 in Act 3, Scene 2, lines 82 following, he says, "If his," that's Claudius's, "if his occulted guilt do not itself unkennel in one speech, it is a damned ghost that we have seen." Not until Claudius's guilty reaction to the play within a play has confirmed the ghost's accusations, not until that moment can Hamlet say, as he does on page 78 in Act 3, Scene 2, line 292, "Oh, good Horatio, I'll take the ghost's word for £1,000. So according to this theological school of thought, up to the end of Act 3, Scene 2, there simply isn't any problem at all about why Hamlet delays. Like the intellectual that he clearly was, the prince was merely trying to establish the truth in the face of quite dramatically conflicting evidence. He was conducting, if you like, in the play with the play, an experiment to check whether or not the facts were as they seemed. Thereafter, after that, after he's convinced that the ghost is telling the truth, Hamlet has only one real opportunity to kill the king. And that is when he catches Claudius on his knees praying. But he doesn't do it. On the other hand, there's no obvious reason, no self-evident reason, for not believing the explanation that Hamlet gives us for not doing it right then. Namely, that if he kills Claudius while he is at prayer and perhaps repenting his sins, then Hamlet fears that Claudius's soul will go straight to paradise, to heaven, the last thing that Hamlet wants. So Hamlet decides to kill Claudius later, as he says in Act 3, Scene 3, lines 89 following on page 85. He's going to kill Claudius when he is drunk, asleep, or in his rage, or in the incestuous pleasure of his bed, at game, a-swearing, or about some act that hath no relish of salvation in it. Then trip him, that his heels may kick at heaven, and that his soul may be as damned and black as hell, whereto it goes. The problem, in turn, with that explanation is simply that it was the Catholic Church, not the Protestant Church, it was the Catholic Church that believed that the state of your soul at the moment of death determined whether you were going to be saved or damned. Hamlet is expounding here a purely and distinctively Catholic doctrine. Very, very, very confusing. However, it's clear that Hamlet thinks he's got a good reason not to kill the king. And as if to confirm that, in the very next scene, Shakespeare shows us Hamlet attempting to carry out his revenge. When he stabs Polonius, remember, who is concealed behind the curtain, eavesdropping on his conversation with the queen, it's clear that Hamlet thinks he is killing Claudius. In Act 3, Scene 4, line 29, on page 87, he says to Gertrude, "Almost as bad, good mother, as kill a king as marry with his brother. I've killed the king, that's bad. Marrying with his brother, which you did, is just as bad. Then, when he discovers that he has in fact killed poor old Polonius, and not Claudius, in the same scene, Act 3, Scene 4, lines 32 following, on page 87, he says to the dead Polonius, "Thou wretched, rash, intruding fool, farewell. I took thee for thy better. I thought you were the king," in other words. Soon after that, Hamlet is packed off to England, and he has no further chance to get to the king until the final scene of the play. So the problem of Hamlet, in the view of this first theological school of critics, the problem of Hamlet is a pure illusion. It's a pseudo-problem with no real basis at all in Shakespeare's play. Hamlet, they believe, these critics, went to work as expeditiously as circumstances would permit. Given the conflicting evidence he was presented with early in the play, his delay was perfectly proper and perfectly understandable. Now, I have to admit that even after all these years, there's something very, very seductive about a theory like this, which reduces everything to a kind of blinding clarity and explains away with a dash of Elizabethan theology a problem that has vexed generation after generation of critics and readers. The problem with this theory is that nobody seems to believe it in the play, not even Hamlet. Over and over again in his soliloquies, the prince rebukes himself for not acting sooner. And in the scene I've just been referring to, Act 3, Scene 4, the interview with Gertrude, remember, the ghost adds his own voice to these reproaches. On page 90 in Act 3, Scene 4, line 111, the ghost says, "This visitation is to whet, to sharpen, thy almost blunted purpose." So the ghost thinks that Hamlet's been delaying and wants him to get on with it. So that's basically the theological school and the problems that I at least have with it. The next school I want to talk about briefly is the moral school. Now, the moral critics do recognize that Hamlet delays. They do admit that Hamlet procrastinates. But they discover the reason for it in his own character, and specifically in his moral repugnance for the task of killing Claudius at all. The argument goes like this. Hamlet, as a Christian, has moral scruples about taking the law into his own hands. And the basis of this idea, the basis for this explanation, is a very, very famous text in St. Paul's Epistle to the Romans, chapter 12, verse 19, which reads, "Dearly beloved, avenge not yourselves, but give place unto wrath. For it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord." And indeed, it is written in the Old Testament. In fact, Paul is quoting Deuteronomy, chapter 32, verse 35. Now, the revenge code, as it's called, the notion that a victim's friends or relatives were obligated to avenge his death if he was murdered, the revenge code originated in two non-Christian cultures. In one, in the early Roman Empire, where it was from which it was transmitted to the Renaissance by the plays of the Roman playwright Seneca. And secondly, it originated quite independently in pre-Christian Northern Europe, where the original Hamlet story had its roots. So the reason that Hamlet can't bring himself to kill Claudius, according to this theory, is simply that Shakespeare has injected the pagan revenge code into a Christian setting. Shakespeare has given a Christian hero, Hamlet, a heathen obligation, revenge, which he cannot fulfill without violating his religious principles. Now, seen from this point of view, the play as a whole is a kind of study in the consequences of what you might call historical anachronism. It's a study, an examination of the results that occur when you superimpose a Christian framework upon material that was originally pagan. Or to put it another way, it's the result of applying Renaissance Christian values to a barbaric Scandinavian folk story. Now, once again, like the earlier theological theory, this one has very obvious attractions. It sounds both historically and psychologically plausible, and the external evidence outside the play seems to support it. A lot of it was made of those verses from Paul and Deuteronomy that I've been quoting. The problem, however, is that the text of Hamlet doesn't support it. Because I cannot find, after all these years again, I cannot find a single reservation expressed either by Hamlet or by anyone else in the play about the propriety of taking revenge on a murderer. Everyone seems to assume that that's the normal thing to do. At no point does the prince even consider the possibility that by killing Claudius, he would be violating the principle expressed in the passage from St. Paul that I've just quoted. On the contrary, when he thinks he has killed the king in the scene that we've just looked at, Act 3, Scene 4, Hamlet expresses nothing but pure satisfaction. And when he discovers that he has made a mistake and killed Polonius, his reaction to that is notable, it seems to me, for its lack of remorse. What does he say? I lug the guts into the neighbor room. That doesn't sound like penitence. Hamlet, the moralist, I am afraid, very much afraid, simply will not do. And that brings us to what I'm calling the psychological solution. And I want to spend the rest of this morning talking about it. This solution, the psychological solution, takes us all the way back to Sophocles' play, Oedipus the King. And it explains in part why Professor McCall and I decided to pair these two texts with each other. Now, you'll remember when Professor McCall was lecturing on the Oedipus, he posed, at one point, an absolutely fundamental question. Is Oedipus himself, Oedipus the character, a uniquely classical Athenian figure with whom a modern reader or spectator has almost nothing in common, whom we see as alien, or is Oedipus a universal figure who transcends his historical and geographical context? Is he a living example of what I called in my opening lecture the doctrine of the unchanging human heart? Well, perhaps the most famous of all this play's various readers and interpreters had absolutely no doubt which was the right answer. He was, of course, Sigmund Freud, whose portrait there is up on the screen on the right-hand side there. Sigmund Freud, who lived from 1856 to 1939, the great Viennese psychiatrist who virtually invented the science, or some would say the pseudoscience, of psychoanalysis. Now, during his life, Freud saw at least three major productions of Sophocles' Oedipus the King. First, he saw a French version at the Comédie Française in Paris in 1885. Then he saw a German version at the Hofburg Theatre in Vienna in 1886. And finally, he saw the Max Reinhardt production in the translation by Hugo von Hofmannsthal, also in Vienna, in 1911. Now, like most of us, even if we've never seen the play but have just read it, like most of us, I think, Freud was repeatedly struck by the play's universal appeal and power. And in his treatise, his famous treatise called The Interpretation of Dreams, Freud set about trying to explain why this particular dramatic plot had affected so many audiences so powerfully over the course of the centuries. Just to illustrate the power of this text, to give you a rough idea of its history, it was recast and translated and adapted over and over again. In the first century AD, the Roman playwright and philosopher Seneca, that I just referred to a moment ago, rewrote the story in Latin. In 1585, an Italian translation of the play was staged to inaugurate the Teatro Olimpico, the first real modern theater in Vicenza in Italy. In the 17th century, the French playwright Corneille retold the story again, this time in French. In the 18th century, Voltaire, the satirist that we're going to be encountering at the end of this course, dramatized the story of Oedipus once again in French. In the 19th century, the English romantic poet Percy Shelley made the story the basis of his verse tragedy, Swellfoot the Tyrant. He'd obviously attended Professor McCall's lectures. And the German philosopher and poet Schiller created a German version of the story in his play Die Braut von Messina. And still more recently, there's been a quite brilliant Broadway production of a modern version of the story by the fabulously successful New York playwright Professor McCall's old nemesis, Herman Hodges. The play is all about an innocent young boy desperately attempting to escape, in a rather undignified way as it turns out, the terrifying fate that is pursuing him through the gymnasium. Its title is Chiptooth He Ran Off. Or, subtitle, How Marsh McCall Lost His Teammate. Now, that is a picture of Mr. Hodges on his way to receive the Nobel Prize for Literature. As you can see, Professor McCall somewhat exaggerated his dimensions and underestimated his intellect. Here, moreover, is a genuine photograph of the original production, starring, by a curious irony, your beloved professor, as he likes to refer to himself, in the role of Chiptooth. In this scene, you can see him asking the oracle at Delphi, played by one of the very greatest actors of our generation, unfortunately concealed behind the Delphic priestess there. He is asking the oracle at Delphi if he can recommend a reliable dentist. As you can see, as he bares his defective tooth, the priestess turns away from him in horror and disgust. Well, to come back to Freud. Freud concluded from his experience that, quote, and I'm quoting him now, if the Oedipus Rex is capable of moving a modern reader or playgoer no less powerfully than it moved the ancient Greeks, the only possible explanation is that the effect of the Greek tragedy does not depend upon the conflict between fate and human free will, but upon the peculiar nature of the material by which this conflict is revealed. Oedipus's fate moves us only because it might have been our own, because the oracle laid upon us before our birth the very curse which rested upon him. It may be, he goes on, that we were all destined to direct, when he says all, of course, he means just men, males, that we were all destined to direct our first sexual impulses toward our mothers, and our first impulses of hatred and violence toward our fathers. Our dreams convince us that we were. King Oedipus, who slew his father and wedded his mother, is nothing more or less than a wish fulfillment fantasy, the fulfillment of the wish of every man's childhood. As the poet brings the guilt of Oedipus to light, by his investigation, Freud concludes, he forces us to become aware of our own inner selves. This damn thing has turned off again, but never mind. I'll try to keep going. In which the same impulses are still extant, even though they are suppressed. Now, what led Freud to this theory? Well, Freud was a very, very careful scholar, and he based this theory on the text of Oedipus, and in particular on two quite startling passages in Sophocles' text. The first passage occurs right after Oedipus learns that the man he thinks is his father, namely Polybus, has died in Corinth of natural causes. And therefore Oedipus thinks he has no need any longer to fear the possibility that he's going to murder his father. His father's already dead. He tells Jocasta, but my mother's bed, however, surely I must fear. It's on, if you want to check it out and go back and look at your texts, it's on page 215 of our edition. And this is how Jocasta replies, because the mother's still alive, and therefore, in theory, he could still sleep with her, right? She says, fear? What should a man fear? Chance rules our lives. And as for this marriage with your mother, have no fear. Many a man before you in his dreams has shared his mother's bed. That's what, of course, Freud fixated on. So, in Freud's words, the dream of having sexual intercourse with one's mother was as common then as it is today. It is the key to the tragedy and the complement to the dream of the death of the father. Well, how about the death of the father? He also finds that in the text of the play. He finds the desire to commit patricide evidenced in another speech that occurs just a few lines earlier than the one I've just quoted, where Oedipus is speaking of Polybus, who he's learned has died. And Oedipus says, this is page 214, 214, lines 1059 to 61. Oedipus says, I never put hand to sword unless some longing for me wasted him away. Then in a sense, you'd say, I caused his death. Now, I consulted Professor McCall on this, and he assures me that in the original Greek, the phrase that our translator renders as some longing for me wasted him away is deeply ambiguous. It could also mean unless perhaps he wasted away as a result of my desire, as a result of my longing. And that's precisely how it was translated in the German versions of the text that Freud saw being performed in Vienna. So then, according to Freud, the story of Oedipus really is the story of every man. The dramatic projection of a male, every male child's secret desires. But Freud wasn't content to leave it there. Other plays, Freud said, also exhibit the Oedipus complex, and none more effectively than Hamlet. He wrote, Hamlet is rooted in the same soil as Oedipus the king, though there is a crucial difference between the two plays, and this is how he defined that difference. In Oedipus, the basic wish fantasy of the child is brought to light and acted out as it is in dreams. In Hamlet, it remains repressed, and we learn of its existence only through the inhibitory effects which proceed from it. Now, this reading of the play was subsequently taken up and developed by Freud's great disciple, a man called Ernest Jones, in a very brilliant book, which you can still check out of the library, called Hamlet and Oedipus. There is Jones there at the bottom on the screen, and sitting next to his great mentor there in the top photograph. Now, in his study, Hamlet and Oedipus, Jones begins by noting that if Hamlet's failure to act can be explained neither by his incapacity for action nor by the difficulty of the task, some other explanation has to be found, some special feature perhaps in the task of revenge that makes it repugnant to him. And the problem, he says, is that no one, not even Hamlet, seems to understand what that inhibiting factor is, why the task of revenge is so repugnant. He offers, Jones quite accurately says, he offers in his soliloquies a whole series of explanations for his delay. But the explanations keep on changing. And as Jones puts it, at one moment he pretends he's too cowardly, at another he questions the truthfulness of the ghost, at another he thinks the time is unsuited, and so on and so on. And consequently, Jones concludes, either Hamlet doesn't know the real reason for his delay, or he is concealing it from himself and from us. Perhaps there is, in Jones's words, some hidden ground for shirking his task, a ground which he dare not or cannot avow to himself or anyone else. And this hidden ground, Jones finds, in the major addition that Shakespeare made to his original sources, those earlier versions of the story I mentioned before. Because what's original and completely new in Shakespeare's version of this story is Hamlet's obsessive concern over what he refers to as his mother's incestuous marriage with Claudius. It's often been said, quite rightly, that this overshadows the revenge motif in terms of the emotional reaction that it arouses in Hamlet. It's the exclusive subject of his first great soliloquy in Act 1, Scene 2. It's the major theme of his most impassioned moment in the play, his confrontation with Gertrude in Act 3, Scene 4. So Jones, it seems to me, is not exaggerating when he says, the crimes that have to be avenged are two, Claudius's incest with the queen and his murder of Hamlet's father. But it is of great importance to note the profound difference in Hamlet's attitude to these two crimes. Intellectually, of course, and morally, he abhors both of them. But there can be no question as to which arouses in him the deepest loathing. Whereas the murder of his father provokes him to anger and despair, Gertrude's marriage with Claudius arouses Hamlet's most intense horror. So Jones concludes that Hamlet is in fact in the grip of what came to be known as an Oedipus complex. In other words, Hamlet would like to do precisely what Claudius has done, namely, kill his father, as Oedipus killed Laius, and marry his mother, as Oedipus married Jocasta, and Claudius has married Gertrude. Claudius's enactment of these suppressed wishes in Hamlet's own subconscious has, according to Jones, brought them back to the surface, reactivated them, with the result that he sees Claudius as his own alter ego, his other self, the self that has actually done what Hamlet him Jr. wants to do. Claudius becomes a living projection of Hamlet's deepest desires. His own evil, Jones says, prevents him from completely denouncing his uncles, and in continuing to repress the former, he must strive to ignore or forget the latter. His moral fate is bound up with his uncles for good or ill, and he cannot kill Claudius without also killing himself. Hamlet, in fact, only kills Claudius when he himself, Hamlet, is dying and when the queen is already dead, so that his conscience, if you like, is free of any ulterior motive for the murder now. On the previous occasion, when he had a perfect chance to kill the king, when Claudius was praying, it was the guilt associated with his Oedipal fantasies, Jones says, that really prevented him and which expressed themselves in Hamlet's choice of the moment when he wants to kill the king, when he is drunk, asleep, or in his bed, or in the incestuous pleasure of his bed. Hamlet thus is impaled on the horns of a terrible dilemma. He would like to kill Claudius because Claudius is now his surrogate father and occupies the same position as Hamlet Sr. once occupied as Gertrude's husband, the rival for the sexual favors of his mother. But on the other hand, he sees in Claudius a mirror image of himself. Claudius is, as I say, in a sense, his alter ego. Claudius has actually done what Hamlet so desperately wanted to, and he can't bring himself to kill his other self. And that explains, I think, an otherwise rather puzzling thing, namely the constant equation in the play between revenge and suicide, which is most evident in the famous to be or not to be soliloquy. Now, Jones's Freudian analysis seemed to me, when I first read it, and still seems to me, to be absolutely dazzlingly brilliant. It explains so much. Its explanatory power is truly remarkable. It explains not only why Hamlet can't kill Claudius until the end of the play, it also explains Hamlet's obsession with Gertrude's sexual relationship with Claudius. It explains the intense self-disgust that emerges so clearly in many of the soliloquies. But this, after all, is one of the great, great attractions of Freud. The Freudian hypothesis assumes that human behavior is ultimately explicable. Freud assumes that there are reasons, even subconscious ones usually, for every single thing that we do. So far from being the advocate of unreason, as he's often described, it seems to me that Freud was one of the greatest rationalists in the Western tradition. And I still find this reading of the play very, very powerful. All right, we'll leave it there and go on next week. Thank you.
The preceding program was brought to you by Stanford on iTunes U and is copyrighted by the Board of Trustees of the Leland Stanford Junior University. Please visit us at itunes.stanford.edu.